of gleaming mirror shades, a shirt with a white ruffled collar, red pants, and a shiny purple trench coat with studs on the left shoulder. For some reason, he looked like the most pissed off one of the bunch. He was also the first one to speak. He pointed down at us with one accusing finger. "There they are," he shouted in a voice that reverberated throughout the arena. "Those are the heretics who broke into our house, trashed our bike, and stole our spaceship. And now they dare to defile our temple grounds." In unison, the other six incarnations of Prince all gasped and then grimaced while exchanging deeply offended looks with one another. Then, as if by telepathic agreement, the attack began. Purple Rain Prince took the lead, and as he fell upon us, his glittering purple trench coat flapped out behind him like a pair of angel wings, while he fired deafening blasts of sonic funk down at us from the head of his glowing H.S. Anderson Mad Cat guitar. They transformed into cracking balls of purple energy that exploded on impact. I took several direct hits from these to my avatar's torso. Luckily, my chain of gold did its job and kept me from sustaining damage. Then, with a sonic boom, Purple Rain Prince was hovering high above us again. He raised his hands and shouted in that booming voice, "Majesty! Divinity!" Two doves rose up from behind him and hovered above his head. They both opened their beaks and fired shriek attacks down at us. After Purple Rain Prince and his two attack doves finished their bombing run, Cloud Suit Prince descended. This incarnation wore a sky blue suit covered in white clouds, and he apparently had the ability to turn his suit invisible and phase shift, rendering him immune to our attacks. Cloud Suit Prince seemed especially pissed off at me and focused all his vocal attacks on my avatar. It took me a few minutes to figure out why. It was his cloud guitar that I was holding, and he wanted it back. Cloud Suit Prince was singing a song from 1984 called "I Would Die for You," but he altered the lyrics of its chorus slightly, so what I heard was, "You will die for me. Yeah, that is how it's gonna be." Each rapid-fire chord he strummed on his Mad Cat fired another sonic blast down at me, like a gunfighter fanning the barrel of his six-shooter. H referred to the next prince in the attack conga line as "Get Off Prince." This one was dressed in a tight-fitting yellow lace suit with two circles cut out in the rear to expose his bare ass cheeks. Thankfully, he didn't fire any sonic attacks from them. Those came from his yellow guitar, which looked identical to mine, aside from the color. I thought I was hallucinating when the next prince descended on us. H referred to him as Gemini. Shoto called him Party Man. My image recognition software's best guess was Bat Dance Prince. To me, he looked like the villain Two-Face, except that he was Batman on the left half and the green-haired Joker on his right half. He hurled joke bombs from one hand and batarangs from the other, then swooped back up and away to dodge our counterattacks. I'm not sure of the correct name for the next incarnation of the attack, but I mentally nicknamed him Microphone Gun Prince. He wore an all-black suit, a black head wrap, and an oversized pair of black sunglasses. He also wielded a pair of gold microphone guns that he wore in black leather holsters on each hip. They looked like pistols, except that their barrels had old-school microphones at the end, which hurled a rapid-fire hail of sonic funk waves down at us. After he unleashed his salvo, he blew away the smoke rising from each microphone gun barrel, then turned and holstered them both as he flew back up into the sky. The next incarnation scared the living crap out of me. Third Eye Prince had a giant round afro and a pair of sunglasses with three lenses. The third lens was centered above the bottom two, and it fired a devastating beam of sonic enlightenment from his concealed third eye, which incinerated everything in its path. After Third Eye Prince finished his bombing run, Purple Rain Prince swooped down to make his second attack, even though he'd only completed his first run about 6 seconds earlier. Meanwhile, I hadn't managed to get off even a single attack of my own, and my chain of gold wouldn't hold out forever. It was a terrifying wake-up call and made me realize how outmatched we really were. The seventh and final incarnation, Mesh Mask Prince, was the only one who didn't swoop down to attack. Apparently unarmed, he continued to hover up above us, silent and motionless, watching the battle below unfold with an impassive expression on his face, at least from what I could see of it through his mask. I finally pulled it together and started to return fire with my cloud guitar, landing two direct hits on Cloud Suit Prince. This appeared to weaken him considerably, and he pulled out of the attack run rotation and remained hovering up above alongside Mesh Mask Prince. Meanwhile, H had pulled up the henchman activation incantation for the original seven on her HUD. Facing Morris and his band, she read it aloud, prefacing each line of the incantation with a snap of her fingers. Snap. Yo, Stella, if you think I'm afraid of you, snap. Grace, if you so much as think I can't do the do, snap. Girl, if you dream I came to jerk around, you better wake up, snap. And release it. As soon as H finished reciting the final two words of the incantation, Morris Day and the Time sprang into action, launching into a song from the Graffiti Bridge film soundtrack called Release It. Our frontman, Morris Day, stepped forward, and a microphone appeared in his hand. He raised it to his lips, tilted his head up at his seven opponents, and spoke. What is your main problem? The moment he said that, a pair of devil horns grew out of his head, and his eyes turned a dark shade of red. Spikes of red lightning shot from his horns, where they arced up to deflect the purple lightning attacks from above. Then he unleashed his walk attack, which involved him making a deafening bird-like walk, laughing, shrieking sound, which unleashed a sonic area of effect attack that injured all seven incarnations at once. But what made Morris an even more fearsome opponent was his right-hand man, Jerome the Mirror Man Benton, who carried around a large gold-framed vanity mirror that he used to create half a dozen mirror image clones of Morris, each of whom began to unleash his own walk attack. The rest of the original seven joined the fight too. Jimmy Jam and Monty Moir each wielded a modified red Roland Access 1 keytar that fired sonic funk blast waves out of its neck each time a chord was played on it. Jesse Johnson fired sonic thunderbolts from the pickups of his Fender Voodoo Stratocaster, while Terry Lewis did the same with his bass, and Jellybean Johnson stood behind them, firing red lightning skyward with his drumsticks, wielding them like two magic wands. Each of the band members could also fire a deadly blast of sonic energy directly from their own mouths, just by shouting the word "Yow!" over and over again. In between his walk attacks, Morris unleashed equally devastating verbal attacks. And for some reason, when the other members of his band repeated what he'd just said, it seemed to power up his verbal sonic attacks and cause them to do even more damage. Morris would shout, "You can't battle me, son! You still wet behind the ears!" And his boys would echo him, "Wet behind the ears!" Morris Day and the Time were magnificent to behold. But in the end, it wasn't enough to save them or us, because the princes had just summoned their henchmen too. Purple Rain Prince summoned his band, the Revolution. They all wore regal outfits with ruffled collars, just like him. Microphone Gun Prince summoned the New Power Generation. There were a bunch of them, and they were all armed to the teeth with every kind of instrument. And then Third Eye Prince summoned his band, Third Eye Girl, which, my HUD informed me, was spelled in all caps. All three bands appeared on the ground, encircling us in the arena. They began to attack us from the surface while six of the princes continued to attack us from the air. That was when H shouted something to Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis about activating their producing powers. They smiled and nodded, and then snapped their fingers in unison, instantly summoning two dozen uniformed henchmen of their own, Janet Jackson and the Rhythm Nation. When they came marching into the arena, H looked like she might pass out. "Holy shit," she said. "I can't believe that worked." And then it became an all-out sonic war. I don't know exactly what happened next or how it all went down, but when the dust settled, all 7 members of the Time had been killed, including Morris Day and all of his mirror images. Purple Rain Prince somehow used his mirror shades to shatter Jerome's mirror, so he was no longer able to use it to make Morris clones. And that was the beginning of the end, I think. But before they died, the original 7 managed to take out all 3 female members of Third Eye Girl, all of the New Power Generation, and every member of the Revolution except for Wendy and Lisa, whom I managed to take out with blasts from my cloud guitar. 4 incarnations of Prince had gone down, but 3 had managed to survive the onslaught: Microphone Gun, Third Eye, and Mesh Mask. But all 3 of them look badly injured and extremely angry about it. I got off another lucky shot from the cloud guitar and managed to nail Third Eye Prince directly in his third eye. Apparently that was his weak spot because he vanished in a shower of glittering purple dust. The last 2 incarnations gasped, and so did H. I felt a glimmer of hope. Maybe we had a shot at winning this thing after all. Then the cloud guitar, which had been rapidly overheating in my hands while I was mentally patting myself on the back, finally exploded, causing me to take several 100 more points of damage. My health bar began to flash bright red. My avatar was near death. By some cruel twist of fate, I happened to have exactly 7 hit points remaining. But it wasn't over yet. There were 3 of us and only 2 princes. "Yes," Shoto cried. "Now we've got them outnumbered, 5 down and 2 to go." And that was when we lost him. Shoto let out a long, hysterical laugh, a clear sign that he was starting to suffer the effects of SOS. Then he signed his avatar's own death warrant. "1-2 princes kneel before you," he sang, while failing to suppress his synaptic overload-induced laughter. "Princes! Princes who adore you!" A horrified look crossed H's face, and she threw her head back to study the sky. A split second later, a purple lightning bolt descended from it and struck Shoto, killing him instantly. H and I watched in horror as Shoto's avatar slowly faded out of existence, leaving all of his items in a pile on the ground. Acting on survival instinct, I ran over to scoop them up and add them to my inventory. H ran over to stand shoulder to shoulder with me. At some point during the melee, Mesh Mask Prince had descended to the ground behind us. He was facing us, standing with his back to the steps that led up to the Temple of 7. He took a menacing step toward us, and as he did, the black stone floor of the arena beneath his feet turned to gold, and so did the floor directly ahead of him, creating a straight gold pathway up the center of the arena and out of its entrance. Where the gold path intersected with the desert highway outside, it began to transmute the asphalt to gold too. I glanced over at H and saw that she was staring intently down at the transmuted gold beneath our feet in wonder, with a thoughtful look on her face. Then she looked back over at Mesh Mask Prince. A woman in a glittering gold dress had appeared beside him. She was dancing and spinning in circles, with a large sword balanced on top of her head. My HUD informed me that this woman was Prince's first wife, Maite Garcia. Floating in the air between Mesh Mask Prince and Maite was a brilliant gold light, like a tiny star. It was too bright to look at directly without being momentarily blinded, and I averted my eyes, but H stared intently at it, ignoring everything else. "This is just like the music video for 7, she shouted. "Is that helpful?" I shouted back. I glanced up and saw that Microphone Gun Prince seemed transfixed by the golden light too. His attacks forgotten, he just hovered above us, staring, and the arena fell silent for the first time since we'd stepped into it. A second later, I heard a woman begin to sing in a clear, beautiful voice. The voice went on singing for several more seconds before I realized that it was H. She was singing a cappella. The lyrics were to a song I had never heard before. All seven, and we'll watch them fall. They stand in the way of love, and we will smoke them all. One day, all seven will die. As she sang, the two incarnations of Prince joined in. Somehow, their collective voices instantly resurrected the other five princes, and they all joined too. When the song was over, the seven incarnations of Prince all floated down and joined hands in front of H. She looked surprised and elated. Then the seven princes morphed and merged, coalescing into one single incarnation of Prince, the one wearing the black mesh mask. A split second later, he transformed into a glowing love symbol, which then melted and morphed into the fifth shard, a purple crystal spinning in the air. I felt no sense of victory because I had no idea what had just happened. All I felt were waves of exhaustion and amazement as I walked over and wrapped my right hand around the shard, bracing myself to relive another piece of Kira Underwood's life. I was Kira once again, and a now middle-aged Ogden Morrow was standing next to me, holding my hand. We were in some sort of small theater or rock club, standing in front of a small, dark, empty stage, which was filled with a cloud of white smoke or fog, possibly created by a smoke machine or dry ice condenser offstage. Hanging over this mist-covered stage was a small, automated lighting rig with a banner suspended from it that said, "Happy 40th Birthday, Kira." Out of the corner of my eye, I could see James Halliday, dressed in an ill-fitting tuxedo, sitting alone in a corner, staring back at me forlornly. I could also hear what sounded like a large crowd of excited, whispering people behind me, but they were just beyond my peripheral vision, and Kira didn't turn her head to look back at them. A split second after I clocked my surroundings, I felt Og squeeze my hand, and a dozen ultra-bright purple spotlights switched on, all converging on a lone figure standing on the stage directly in front of us. It was Prince, dressed in a glittering, sequined purple suit. When she saw him, I felt Kira's heart begin to beat so rapidly, I worried she might pass out. I could feel myself swaying ever so slightly and felt unsteady on my feet, because before I knew what was happening, the purple one himself was approaching me. Then he was kneeling down on the stage in front of me, just a few feet away. He raised a golden microphone and sang "Happy Birthday, Kira" to me, or rather, her. And then I was back on the afterworld, in the center of the courtyard arena, in front of the Temple of the Seven, holding the fifth shard in my outstretched hand. I resisted the urge to immediately check it for an inscription. Shoto was more important. I pulled up my HUD and called Faisal, adding H to the call just before Faisal's face appeared in front of us. We both began to bark questions at him, asking about Shoto's condition. Once Faisal got us to quiet down, he told us that Shoto appeared to be fine, at least as far as they could tell. "It's the same as the rest," Faisal explained. "All vital signs are normal, and he's still logged into his Oasis account, but we can't locate his avatar anywhere in the simulation." Faisal shook his head and shrugged. "He appears to be stuck in limbo, just like all the other ONI hostages whose avatars have died." "What will happen when he hits his ONI usage limit?" I asked. "Will he still start to suffer the effects of synaptic overload syndrome?" Faisal nodded. "Yes, our engineers think so anyway. It seems likely that Anorak would have written his in firmware to ensure that all of his ONI hostages remain his captives, even after their avatars die." "But why doesn't he just let their avatars respawn?" H asked. "They would still be his hostages." "We're not sure," Faisal said. "Perhaps he's doing it to scare all of us? To keep all of his hostages in line by making avatar death permanent? If so, it's working, at least on me." Faisal told us that Shoto's pregnant wife Kiki and the rest of his extended family were still standing vigil beside his OIV at his home in Hokkaido. They could see his sleeping body on his immersion vault's internal cameras, which were linked to a video monitor mounted on the wall above it. There was nothing GSS's engineers could do for him. They weren't even trying to cut him out of his OIV because they knew they couldn't get him out in time. And even if they could, it wouldn't matter. As long as Shoto remained logged into the Oasis, his ONI headset would stay locked into place around his head. And until we managed to free Shoto's mind from the Oasis, his comatose body would continue to be locked inside his OIV, just a few feet away from his family, but totally out of reach. When Faisal finished answering our questions about Shoto, he couldn't help himself. In a panicked voice, he began to ask us how close we were to finding the sixth shard. I hung up on him without answering. Then I closed my HUD and looked down at the fifth shard, which I was still clutching in my right hand. I turned it over until I found an inscription on one of its facets. I held the shard out so that H could read it too. Win her hand through a feat of dark renown. The last two shards are set in Morgoth's crown. When I saw the last two words of the inscription, I couldn't believe my eyes. I tried to think of a worse place for the last two shards to be hidden. There wasn't one. Halliday had put them in the deepest, darkest, and deadliest dungeon fortress in the entire Oasis, in the possession of one of the most ridiculously overpowered and evil NPCs ever created. An NPC who was immortal, nigh invulnerable, and capable of killing most 99th level avatars with his breath. For all intents and purposes, the last two shards were located in the depths of hell, set into the crown of Satan himself. I started to laugh. It was just a rapid-fire giggle at first, but then I couldn't stop, and it quickly grew into the loud, uncontrolled laughter of a sane soul pushed to the brink of madness by cruel chance, just before fate drop-kicked them over the edge of a cliff. I checked my ONI usage countdown, and I still had over an hour remaining, so I couldn't be experiencing the onset of SOS. Not yet, which meant I was just starting to lose it. H stared at me with an uncertain look on her face until I managed to get my laughter under control. "Okay, Chuckles," she said. "Now, are you going to tell me what's so funny? I take it you know where we need to go next?" I took a deep breath. Then I wiped away the tears at the corners of my eyes and nodded. "Yeah," I said. "Unfortunately, I do, H." "Well," H said, "don't make me look it up. Who the hell is Morgoth?" I studied her face. I could see that she wasn't joking. She really didn't know. And this realization nearly set me off again, but I managed to keep a lid on it. "Morgoth Boglair," I said. "The Dark Lord, formerly known as Melkor." H's eyes lit up. "Melkor," she replied. "Vin Diesel's avatar? Named after his old D&D character?" "Vin borrowed that name from the Silmarillion," I replied. "Melkor, who later became known as Morgoth, was the most powerful and evil being ever to roam the face of Arda, also known as Middle Earth." When she heard the words Middle Earth, H inhaled sharply. "Are you telling me that I have to spend the last hour of my life surrounded by a bunch of fucking hobbits, Z?" I shook my head. "All the hobbit NPCs live on Arda 3. I pointed to the name etched into the fifth shard. "Morgoth only resided on Arda during the first age of Middle Earth, which means we need to teleport to Arda 1, and that planet is a completely hobbit-free zone." "No hobbits?" she said. "Seriously?" "No hobbits," I replied. "Just elves, humans, and dwarves." "Let me guess," she said. "They're all white, right? White elves, white men, and white dwarves. I bet everyone we encounter on this Tolkien planet is going to be white, right? Except, of course, for the bad guys, the black-skinned orcs." "Saruman the White was a bad guy," I replied, losing my temper. "We don't have time for literary criticism right now, H, valid though it may be, okay?" "Okay, Z," she replied, holding up both of her hands. "Geez, cool your tool. We'll table that discussion until later." I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "Sorry, I said. I'm just exhausted. And I'm scared. For Shoto and Og and everyone else. I know, she replied. I am too. It's okay, Z. She gave my shoulder a squeeze, then nodded at me. I nodded back. Any word from Lohengrin yet? H asked. Or Artie? I checked my messages and shook my head. Not yet. H took a deep breath. Okay, I'm ready, she said. Let's get this over with. I nodded. Then I teleported both of us directly to the surface of Ardo 1 and into the first age of J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth. 0024. Like Shermer and the Afterworld, Ardo 1 had a limited number of designated teleportation arrival and departure points scattered across its surface. Unfortunately, all but one of them was grayed out for me because I hadn't completed any of the quests required to gain access to them. So I selected the only arrival point I could, which was located in the middle of a frozen wasteland called the Helcarazay. On the map, the same region was also labeled as the Grinding Ice. But when the teleportation process completed and our avatars rematerialized on the surface of Ardo 1, we didn't find ourselves in the environment we were expecting. There wasn't any ice or snow in sight. H and I were standing beside a small lake located somewhere high in the mountains. The star-filled sky over our heads was reflected in the water's still smooth surface, creating the illusion that there was a blanket of stars both above and below us. It was quiet, save for the singing of crickets and the distant howl of wind whipping over the dark hills that loomed all around us. It was a beautiful scene, but I had absolutely no idea where the hell we were. When I pulled up my map of Arda to check our location, I discovered that we were nowhere near the Helcarazay. We were over 400 miles east, up in the Dorthonian Highlands, standing on the shores of a lake called Tarn Ailuin. This wasn't one of Arda's designated arrival points, so it shouldn't even have been possible for us to teleport to this location. It had to be the shards that had brought us here, but I didn't have the first clue as to why. I continued to scan my map of Arda, looking for the name Yudun. I knew that it was once the name of Morgoth's fortress because in the Fellowship of the Rings, when Gandalf faces off against the Balrog of Morgoth at the Bridge of Khazad-dûm, he calls it the Flame of Uduin. But I couldn't find any sign of it on my map, nor was there a label for its Sindarin equivalent, Utumno. And when I searched the index, it confirmed that there was no location known by either of those names anywhere on the planet. I cursed myself, once again, for never bothering to study the First Age. Then I bit the bullet and opened Gunterpedia in a browser window in front of me and pulled up the entry on Utumno. I immediately saw my mistake. Utumno was the name of Melkor's original dungeon stronghold, but it was completely destroyed just before the First Age began, so it wasn't located on Ardo 1 at all, but on the Springtime of Arda, another, much smaller, disc-shaped planet located directly beneath Ardo 1, 2, and 3. Most Gunters referred to it as Arda 0. It was a simulation of Arda during the Years of the Trees, which took place before the First Age. I'd never even bothered to visit Arda 0 because it was impossible to complete any of the quests there unless you had already completed every single quest on Arda 1, Arda 2, and Arda 3. I let out a heavy sigh, thinking I was going to have to suffer the embarrassment of telling H that I'd teleported both of us to the wrong planet. But after searching my memory, I recalled something Aragorn said in the Fellowship of the Ring when he was telling the story of Beren and Lúthien to the hobbits. In those days, the great enemy, of whom Sauron of Mordor was but a servant, dwelt in Angband in the north. I checked my map again, looked to the north, and located Angband right away. It was in the middle of the arid Engreen, a vast mountain range that stretched across the northern reaches of the continent. In the common tongue, they were known as the Iron Mountains, and the Angband was also known as the Iron Prison. That was one of the many things that made navigating Middle-earth difficult, Everything and everyone had at least two or three different names, each in a different made-up language. It got confusing, even for a massive geek like me. I pulled up my digital copy of The Fellowship of the Ring and located the sentence where Aragorn first mentions Ongband. A few paragraphs beneath it, I found the passage I was looking for. Tenuvial rescued Beren from the dungeons of Sauron, and together they passed through great dangers and cast down even the great enemy from his throne and took from his iron crown one of the three Silmarils, brightest of all jewels, to be the bride price of Lúthien to Thingol, her father. That seemed to confirm my theory. Here, on this iteration of Arda, Morgoth's throne was located in his dungeon forest of Ongband, and it was just 80 miles to the north of our current location. Bingo! That had to be why the shards had brought us here. I turned toward H. We're headed to Ongband, Morgoth's dungeon fortress, about 80 miles north of here. I pointed out over the lake and the dark hills beyond it, to the growing mass of dark clouds roiling above the distant northern horizon. They were lit by eruptions of red lightning from within and by the enormous silver globe of the moon, shining high in the eastern sky, which cast a pale glow over everything beneath it. H looked out over the lake, toward those dark clouds on the northern horizon. 80 miles? H repeated. Yeah, I said, and magic items or spells that give you the ability to fly won't function here. Since we can't teleport there either, we'll have to travel by land. H reached down and tapped the stripes on the side of the white Adidas she was wearing. When she did, the stripes changed color, from blue and black to yellow and green, and the shoes themselves began to glow and crackle with bolts of energy that were the same combination of colors. Got blue and black because I like to chill, H recited, and yellow and green when it's time to get ill. She pointed down at her glowing, crackling sneakers. My Adidas give me the ability to run at 3 times the normal speed. Do you want me to cast Mordenkainen's mojo on you so you can keep up with me? I shook my head. I've got a better idea. From my own inventory, I removed 2 small glass figurines shaped like horses. Both were silver gray in color. I set them gently on the ground in front of us and backed away several steps. Figurines of wondrous power? H asked. I nodded, and she immediately took several steps backward, too. Once she was clear, I spoke the activation words. Felaroth, I shouted. Shadowfax! Both figurines instantly grew and morphed into a pair of full-size horses, which abruptly came to life, snorting and whinnying as they reared back on their mighty hind legs. They were stunningly beautiful creatures, with nearly identical silver-gray coats. They were both decked out in mithril plate armor that I'd purchased for them, along with custom-made saddles carved from dark green elven wood, inlaid with bands of gold that were engraved with their names in Fenorian script. These are the 2 fastest land animals ever to roam Middle-earth, I said. I obtained them by completing quests on Arda 3, but they should have the same speed and abilities here. Just make sure to hold on tight. They can really move, okay? H nodded and powered down her Adidas. Then she put one of them in Felaroth's stirrups and swung herself up into the saddle on his back. I walked over to Shadowfax and patted him gently on the neck and told him it was good to see him again in Sindarin. Then I pulled myself up into his saddle and moved him alongside H and Felaroth. I removed 2 magic swords that I'd acquired on Arda 3 from my inventory. One was the Ithilnar broadsword named Glamdring, wielded by Gandalf during the War of the Ring, and I equipped it in the scabbard on my avatar's back. The other was a 2-handed sword, and I took hold of it by its blade and held it out to H, hilt first. Here, I said, you're going to need this. Anduril, the Flame of the West, reforged from the shards of Narsil by... H waved the sword away. No thanks, Z, H said. I've already got plenty of swords of my own. I continued to hold the sword out to her. Take it, I said. Only magical weapons forged by the elves of Middle-earth can affect the servants of Morgoth, okay? I do know 1 or 2 things about this place. H relented and took the sword. Then she equipped it in its scabbard at her side. "Happy now?" she asked. "I'll be happy once we've got the last two shards," I said. "We're almost to the end. You ready, H?" She flashed her Cheshire grin at me. Then, doing her best Jack Burton impression, she said, "Z, I was born ready." I laughed, and together we both spurred our horses forward. Shadowfax and Felleroth launched us north with the speed of loosed arrows. Their hooves thundered against the ground beneath us like the steady beat of war drums as they carried us away from Tarn Ailuin, across the moonlit highlands, toward the increasingly dark clouds looming on the horizon. We raced our magical steeds at top speed across the heather-covered hills and plains of Dorthonion. When we reached a dense forest of pines along its northern border called Tar Nu Fuin, our mounts were forced to slow their pace slightly as they weaved their way through it. But they still raced through, around, and under the trees at such blinding speed that I kept imagining myself as a doomed stormtrooper on a speeder bike. But our steeds were magical creatures known as Maris, who had the ability to glide across the landscape at incredible speed, regardless of the terrain beneath their hooves. I heard H ride up behind me. When I glanced over at her, she was staring at me, aghast. I didn't understand why, until her eyes shifted to the browser window I still had open in front of me, displaying the Gunterpedia entry about Ongbond. I'd forgotten to change my privacy settings, so any browser windows I'd opened were still automatically visible to my fellow clan members. "You don't have any idea what we're supposed to do when we get there, do you?" she said. "You were looking it up! I just saw you looking it up!" "I was just refreshing my memory, H, that's all." "Okay," H replied. "Then tell me, what do we do when we get there? How do we get inside his fortress? And how the fuck are we supposed to get the shards out of Morgoth's crown? You said the dude was invincible." She continued to stare over at me as we both bounced up and down in our saddles, awaiting my answer. "I'm not sure yet," I admitted, "but I know that Baron and Luthien were able to cast down Morgoth and steal one of the jewels from his crown, but I don't know how they did it. I think that story is in the Silmarillion, and I never finished reading that, but I'll skim the Cliff's Notes on our way to Ongbond, okay? I'll figure out what we need to do, I promise." H looked as if I just slapped her across the face. "What the frack, Z?" she shouted. "I thought you had this hobbit shit handled. You told me you were an expert on Tolkien, man." I shook my head. "I never said expert," I replied. "Artemis is the expert. I'm really only familiar with the third age of Middle-earth. That's when The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings take place. I'm sort of an expert on Arda 3. I mean, I've completed every single quest there." I didn't mention that I'd completed them all years ago during Halliday's contest, back when I was still leveling up my avatar, or that the quests on Arda 3 were a lot more up my alley. That planet was covered with oasis ports of a bunch of different early video and role-playing games set in Middle-earth, created by companies like Beam Software, Interplay, Vivendi, Stormfront, and Iron Crown Enterprises. In fact, one of the very first quests I'd ever completed in the Oasis was a port of the original Hobbit text adventure located on Arda 3, which Kira Morrow was rumored to have helped create. Just thinking of it made me recall a line of text from the game, one that it spat out over and over again any time I lingered too long in one location. Time passes. Thorin sits down and starts singing about gold. I'd even completed the incredibly hard-to-reach quests in the extreme eastern and southern regions of Middle-earth, in which you had to face off against the evil cults founded by Alatar and Palando. "I don't give a shit about Arda 3Z," H said. "What about this planet? How many quests have you completed here on Arda 1? H could always tell when I was lying to her, so I didn't even bother trying. "Zero, okay?" I replied. "Not a single one. But there's a good reason for that, H. Don't make that face at me. All the quests here are trivia traps. You can't complete them unless you possess an encyclopedic knowledge of Tolkien's entire legendarium. And I'm not just talking about the published version of the Silmarillion. You need to memorize details of a bunch of different, conflicting, unpublished early drafts and all 13 volumes of The History of Middle-earth. Sorry, I had research priorities. Like what? H said, rolling her eyes. Watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail for the 200th time? That was one of Halliday's favorite films, H, I shouted. Knowing it by heart helped us reach the egg you may recall, and it also happens to be a comedic masterpiece. So, you told me you'd read every novel by every single one of Halliday's favorite authors, and Tolkien was on his list of favorites, man. I sighed. The Silmarillion isn't a novel, H. It's more like a campaign-setting sourcebook for the Middle-earth role-playing game. It's full of stories and poems about the creation of Middle-earth, its deities, history, and mythology, alphabets and pronunciation keys for made-up elven languages. I just never had time to finish it. H studied my face for a few seconds in silence. Then she pretended to sniff the air. I smell bullshit, Watts, she said, narrowing her eyes. You have never been one to half-ass your research, and you knew that Kira Mora was a Tolkien fanatic. She lived in a replica of Rivendell, for God's sake. Why wouldn't you study every single... She paused for a moment. Then her eyes suddenly widened in understanding. Aha! She exclaimed. Now I get it. You've been sleeping on this Elder Days shit because of Samantha, right? Because she's a huge Tolkien fan, too. She shook her head. You're still hung up on her, aren't you, Watts? She motioned to our surroundings. What, does this place remind you of her or something? I started to deny it, but H was right, and she knew it. Yes, okay, I said. This whole fucking place reminds me of her. I motioned to our surroundings. That music you hear right now, the Howard Shore film scores that play on a continuous loop everywhere you go on this godforsaken planet, they remind me of Samantha, too. She likes to listen to this music while she falls asleep. At least, she used to. The memory of the moment I learned this about her began to surface, and I could feel it twisting my insides into knots as it did so. So, I shook my head vigorously until it was banished from my thoughts. Then, I locked eyes with H again. My entire real-world relationship with Samantha only lasted for 1 week, H, I said. That week, we all spent together at the Morrow's replica of Rivendell. She loved being there, and she loved geeking out about Middle-earth. I think Samantha loves Tolkien as much as Kira did, maybe even more. I gave H a guilty look. Samantha found out I'd never finished reading The Silmarillion that week, I said, and she gave me an enormous amount of shit about it. I was planning to give it another go, but then we broke up. And I've avoided Tolkien since. It was just too painful. H gave me a sympathetic smile. Then she leaned over in her saddle to punch me softly in the shoulder. Z, she said. Maybe there's a reason why the last two shards are hidden here, on a planet Artie knows better than you. Fate wants her to be here. Artie isn't available to help us at the moment, remember? I replied, and we agreed to maintain radio silence until we have the last two shards. We have to stick to the plan. H nodded and was silent for a moment. At least send her a text message, H said, and let her know where we are and what we're up against. I nodded and tapped the messaging icon on my HUD. I kept the note short and sweet. Dear Artie, the clue on the fifth shard says, the last two shards are set in Morgoth's crown. We're on Arda and are headed to Ongbond right now, but we could really use your help. Shoto is gone. It's just me and H now. If you can't do anything to help us from where you are, we understand. We'll do our best without you. MTFB WYA, Z and H. I showed the message to H. She nodded her approval, and I hit send. Why do you think Kira was so nuts about Middle-earth? H asked me as we continued to gallop through the dark forest. Pure, uncut escapism, I said. Tolkien's work directly inspired the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, and then D&D, in turn, inspired the first generation of video game designers who tried to recreate the experience of playing D&D on a computer. Kira, Og, and Halliday, they all grew up playing D&D and the video games inspired by it. And that inspired all of them to make computer role-playing games. That's how we got the Anorak's Quest series and eventually the Oasis. If it weren't for Tolkien, all of us nerds would have had a lot less fun during the last 90 years. Ah, H said. So he's partly to blame for all this. She flashed her Cheshire grin at me again to let me know that she was kidding. As we sped onward, I found myself gazing in wonderment at my surroundings. Even now, I couldn't help but be awed by the scope and detail of Tolkien's imagination. After almost a century, artists and storytellers and programmers were still drawing inspiration from his creation. When we emerged from the forest's northern border, our horses came to an abrupt halt, and H and I found ourselves staring out across a charred and desolate wasteland, which stretched out ahead of us as far as the eye could see. It looked like several hundred atomic bombs had been detonated here, all within the past few months. In the distance, the Iron Mountains stretched across the entire northern horizon. And near their very center, straight ahead of us, three enormous, impossibly tall black volcanoes rose up from the mountain range, looming over its peaks and stretching up into the thick black clouds that were roiling in the sky above. I was tired of checking my map every few minutes to find out what I was looking at, so I did something that most self-respecting Gunters would never do. I turned on my Oasis tour guide captions and activated my image recognition software. When I took another look at the wasteland stretching out ahead of us, a caption appeared on my HUD, informing me that I was staring at the barren dunes of An Fowglith, a desolate hellscape created by Morgoth when he scorched the once green plains of Ard Ghaelan, black with the fires of Thangorodrim, which was the name of the three volcanic peaks looming high above the horizon ahead. One does not simply walk into Dor Dydaloth, I said, assuming that H wouldn't get the joke. She didn't. Dor what? She replied. Dor Dydaloth, I said, motioning to the scorched landscape around us, the land of Morgoth, the Dark Lord himself. Yeah, I meant to ask you about that, H said. In all three of those extremely long Hobbit movies you made me watch, wasn't some dude named Sauron the Dark Lord of Middle-earth? Yes, I replied, but he didn't get promoted to that position until late in the Second Age, after Morgoth was banished to the Void. Then Sauron rose to power. But here, during the First Age, Sauron was just one of Morgoth's demonic generals, and he was also a shapeshifter who could transform into a wolf or a bat. Sauron isn't around here right now, is he? She asked uneasily, eyeing the dark skies overhead. Once again, I wasn't sure. I had to check the entry on Sauron in Gunterpedia. Sauron is in command of Tal Sirion, I said, reading off my hood, an island fortress located over 100 miles west of here. I don't think we'll run into him. That's a relief, she replied, relaxing her posture a bit. No, H, I replied. It isn't. Sauron is a pushover compared to this Morgoth dude. He is one of the toughest, if not the toughest, NPCs in the entire simulation. According to what I've read about him, he's all-powerful and invulnerable. What do you mean, invulnerable? I mean, he can't be killed, I said. From what I've read on the Gunter message boards, it's supposed to be possible to banish Morgoth to the Void indefinitely, but to do that, first you have to complete a whole series of epic-level quests to enlist the help of the Valar, and those would probably take weeks to complete. That is, if I knew enough about the Elder Days to complete all of them, which I don't. Okay, H said, taking this in. Then if we can't kill Morgoth, how are we supposed to get the last two shards out of his crown? I'm still working on that, I said, motioning to the array of browser windows I had open in the air around me, each displaying a different Gunterpedia entry. Just give me a few more minutes. Come on, Z, she said, let's keep moving. She was about to spur her horse forward once again, but I grabbed the reins to stop her. Hold on, I said. Before we go any further, we should probably try and conceal ourselves so we don't get attacked by any roving bands of orcs. You got any invisibility spells memorized? H nodded. Of course, she said. How about Ossuvox's improved obfuscation? It's 99th level. It'll conceal us from everything, including infravision, ultravision, and true sight. Perfect, I said. Can you cast it on both of us and on the horses too? She nodded and muttered a few incantations. When she completed them, we and our horses all became invisible. But we could still see a semi-transparent version of each other's avatars and our steeds on our HUDs, allowing us to avoid bumping into each other. Then we continued to speed northward, across the barren landscape, toward the three towers of black glass and volcanic rock rising from the bleak mountain range in the distance. We spotted a large hill up ahead of us, rising from the flat and desolate landscape around it. But once we drew a bit closer to this hill, it revealed itself to be an enormous mound of dead bodies. The slain and dismembered corpses of thousands of elves and men. My tour guide subtitles helpfully informed me that this was Hauthendengin, the Mound of the Slain. I covered my mouth and nose with my cloak in an attempt to fend off the foul stench that filled the air. I glanced over at H and saw that she was doing the same. H stared at the giant pile of corpses as we rode past it. Then she turned in her saddle to face me and raised her voice to be heard over the drum of our horse's hoofbeats. "Are you sure you don't want to call for some backup, Z?" H said. "You could try your St. Crispin's Day shtick again. Send out a message to every user in the Oasis asking for them to come here and help us." "It won't work this time," I said. "No one would come." "Sure they would," H said. "If you told them the truth and let them know that every single ONI user's life depends on our success, I bet at least a few thousand of them would come to our aid." "An army won't help us this time," I said. "The Noldor laid siege to Angband for over 400 years, and they never even got close to the Silmarils." I shook my head. "I think we're going to have to sneak inside, like Beren and Luthien." "Who and who?" "A mortal man and an immortal elf maiden who fell in love," I said, motioning to a copy of the Silmarillion I had open in a window beside me. "They were able to sneak into Angband and steal one of the Silmarils from the Iron Crown by putting Morgoth and his minions to sleep." I turned to look at H. "What's the most powerful sleep spell you have in your spellbook?" She pulled up her spell list and scanned it for a few seconds. "Mordenkainen's Everlasting Slumber," she said. "And I'm 99th level, so it should be powerful enough to put any NPC within its area of effect down for the count, even if they do make their saving throws." "Good," I replied. "You'll need to cast it at least twice. The entrance into Angband is supposed to be guarded by a giant black wolf named Kar-Harath. We'll have to put him to sleep to make it past him and get inside. Then, once we find our way to Morgoth's throne room, we need to put everyone there to sleep too. Then I think we should be able to steal the shards out of his crown." H nodded and silently made a few quick changes to her list of memorized spells. Then she gave me two thumbs up. "Okay," I said, "that should do the trick. I think we're ready." "Let's hope so," she said, as we both spurred our anxious horses forward, carrying us away from the Mound of the Slain and onward toward the gates of Angband, which lay at the base of Thangorodrim, whose three enormous peaks continued to loom up ahead of us, rising high above the iron mountains beneath them. I used the magnification feature on my HUD to zoom in on the peaks of the three massive volcanic mountains and could just make out the spot on the western peak where the elven prince Maethros was chained to a rocky cliff, waiting to be rescued. On the eastern peak, I spotted another prisoner of Morgoth, a man named Húrin, bound to a chair high atop Thangorodrim. Apparently, these NPCs were always there as part of some other high-level Elder Days quests that took place in these mountains. A few minutes later, H and I found ourselves riding on a long, narrow road that led up to the massive gates of Angband, which were set deep into the base of Thangorodrim's central peak. On either side of the road lay large, open chasms, filled with thousands of giant, writhing black serpents, all squirming together in one twisted mass. Up above, demonic-looking vultures perched on the rocky cliffs, glaring and squawking down at us. I realized that H's invisibility spell didn't appear to have any effect on the creatures that resided here, so I asked her to deactivate it. She complied, and we continued our way up to the two massive iron doors set into the sheer cliff wall ahead. When we came within a few hundred yards of the gates, our horses refused to proceed any farther. H and I dismounted. Then I spoke the name of each horse once again, and they shrank and morphed back into tiny glass figurines, which I scooped up and placed back inside my inventory. On foot now, we reached the gates to see that they were standing wide open, but a giant black wolf lay guarding the rocky plateau in front of them, glaring down at us with a pair of unblinking eyes that glowed bright red in the shadow of Ongbond. This was Karharoth, one of the most fearsome creatures of the Elder Days. When H got a look at the size of the wolf, she reached down with both hands and tapped the stripes on the sides of her Adidas once again, and their color scheme changed from blue and black to silver and gold. "Got a pair that I wear when I'm playing ball," H recited, "with the heel inside, make me 10 feet tall." When she finished speaking the command phrase, she suddenly grew in size until her avatar stood exactly 10 feet tall. Thanks to the change in proportions, Karharoth would no longer tower over her. Now, she would be able to stare him directly in his demonic red eyes. Karharoth continued to glower down at us until we reached the end of the road and arrived at the base of the steps leading up to the entrance. As H and I started to ascend the steps, she began to cast her sleep spell on the giant wolf, making intricate patterns in the air with her hands as she whispered the words of the incantation. But when the spell was complete, Karharoth didn't close his glowing red eyes, and he did not drift off to sleep. Instead, he bared his teeth and lunged down to attack us. He ignored H and came directly at me, probably because I was the one with the shards in my inventory. I raised my sword and took several steps backward as Karharoth snapped with a black maw full of razor-sharp fangs. I continued to retreat back down the steps as the giant wolf advanced upon me, snapping his jaws again and again, just inches from my face. I struck him repeatedly with Glamdring, but the sword's glowing blue blade didn't even appear to break the wolf's skin, not even when I managed to stab him directly in his black, slime-covered gums. Karharoth turned to lunge at H, snapping his jaws shut on her leg. Then the beast shook her fiercely and hurled her aside, but H landed on her feet and counterattacked, hurling balls of fire and lightning from each of her hands, firing off one spell after another. I tried to attack the giant wolf while he was distracted by H's fusillade, but he somehow sensed my approach, and before I could land a hit with my sword, he craned his neck around and bit me in the shoulder. My avatar took over 100 points of damage, and then a message popped up on my HUD, informing me that the wolf's teeth were covered with some sort of venom, and that I would keep on losing more hit points every few seconds from poison damage. Karharoth's venom had also temporarily immobilized my avatar, leaving me wide open for another attack. H and I had faced a lot of formidable enemies over the years, on a lot of different planets. The two of us once took down a Tarrasque on Faerun in less than 5 minutes. We live-streamed it. It was a cakewalk. But after less than 30 seconds, Karharoth already had both of us on the run and hemorrhaging hit points. I took a potion of cure poison out of my inventory and swallowed it in one gulp, but to my horror, I saw my hit point counter continue to fall. I was still taking poison damage. The potion was supposed to cure it, but it wasn't working. Just like H's sleep spell hadn't worked on the wolf. Clearly, I had missed something. Just as Karharoth began to slink toward me to make another attack, I saw H's enlarged avatar leap off the stairs behind him and onto his back. As he began to whirl and thrash around, H somehow managed to flip up and over the beast, land with both feet on the bridge of its nose, and stab it directly between its fiery red eyes. Then, as the beast howled and reared back in agony, H did another somersault and landed on the ground directly in front of him. While he was temporarily blinded, she put everything she had into another volley of attacks with her sword. H had saved me for the moment, but I could see that the bite to her leg had seriously weakened her. She appeared to have been poisoned by its venom too, because her movements had slowed considerably. She dodged desperately as Karkaroth continued to swipe at her with his massive black claws, but after just a few seconds, the giant wolf knocked her off balance and clamped his jaws shut on her avatar's midsection. I cried out H's name in anguish because I knew the beast had struck a killing blow. H turned to lock eyes with me just before she went limp and fell to the ground. Then, her avatar slowly disappeared, leaving behind a pile of spinning items, all of the weapons and armor in her inventory. I stood there in shock for a second, wondering if I'd just lost my best friend forever. But I couldn't let myself believe that, so I lunged forward and scooped up all of the items H had dropped, adding them to my own inventory with the hope that I would be able to return them to her later. Then I took up the sword I had given her, and Juriel, and equipped it in my left hand so that I could wield it along with Glamdring in my right. Both of the elven blades continued to glow bright blue as I turned to face Karkaroth. I may have looked a bit silly wielding two such large swords at the same time, but my avatar's combat stats made it effortless, and I had double weapon proficiency and ambidextrous attacks, so I got three attacks per round with each sword with each hand. Karkaroth glared at me with his glowing red eyes, and as he did, I noticed that they matched the hit point counter on my HUD, which was flashing to remind me that my avatar was just a few seconds away from being dead. And when my avatar died, I wasn't going to respawn and wake up in a brand new virtual body. I was going to end up just like H and Shoto and all the others, trapped in an ONI-induced coma with little hope of ever regaining consciousness. Karkaroth kept advancing, and I kept retreating, until he had me cornered at the edge of the plateau. He moved in closer and prepared to make his second kill, spreading his massive jaws in a rictus grin as he approached me. I raised both of my ancient elven swords in an attempt to defend myself. But I knew it was hopeless. This was it. I was about to die a very real death. And my quest was about to end in total failure. A failure that would likely result in the deaths of millions of other people, including my two best friends. And I would never have the chance to make things right with Artie, to tell her that I loved her more than any other person who had ever come into my life. This was not how I wanted to die. Not even close. And then, my ex-girlfriend fell out of the sky. 0025. First, I heard the insistent squeaking of a bat as Karkaroth snarled and closed in on me. I caught a brief glimpse of the bat's wings flittering across the edge of my peripheral vision. Then, I heard a familiar transformation sound effect, one I knew had been lifted from the old Super Friends cartoon. And a split second later, Artemis made a superhero landing on the rocky ground directly between me and Karkaroth. Then she rose to her full height and faced off against the wolf warden of the Gates of Hell, her long black cloak whipping out behind her in the wind like a cape. Karkaroth froze in mid-step and cocked his head sideways to regard her like a curious dog. Artemis took a step forward and raised both of her hands toward the giant wolf as if to embrace him. Then she began to sing, and as she did, music arose out of nowhere to accompany her. "Oh, woe-begotten spirit," Artemis sang to Karkaroth, her amplified voice echoing off the high stone walls of Thangorodrim. "Fall now into dark oblivion and forget for a while the dreadful doom of life." The giant wolf's eyes fluttered, briefly obscuring the fiery red coals burning at the center of each of his pupils. Then his eyes slammed shut, and the mighty Karkaroth dropped to the ground in front of Artemis, causing a small earthquake. When the tremors subsided, the only sound in that desolate place was that of the giant beast snoring. But even before Carcharoth hit the ground, Artemis was already rushing to my side. She laid her hands on the bite wound on my shoulder, which had already begun to fester, turning the skin and veins around it black. Then she began to sing another song. This one had elvish lyrics that I didn't understand, and my translator subtitles were obscured by my hit point counter, which now filled my entire HUD. It was also flashing red to ensure that I knew my avatar now only had 5 hit points remaining. Then Artemis finished her brief song, and my hit point counter jumped back up to maximum, and it stayed there, an indication that I had also been cured of the ongoing effects of the wolf's deadly venom. I just lay there on the ground, shaking. Then I felt Artemis take my hand, and I opened my eyes to see her staring down at me. "Thank you," I said, throwing my arms around her. My voice came out as a whisper. "Thank you for saving me. Thank you for coming back." I forced myself to let go of her. "I'm glad you're feeling better," she said, "but what were you thinking?" She shook her head. "That you could just roll up to the gates of Ongbond completely unprepared and half-ass your way through the quest of the Silmaril?" "I was not completely unprepared," I replied indignantly. "Did you happen to notice that I'm wielding both Anduril and Glamdring right now?" I pointed up the road. "And I rode in here on Shadowfax. I'm doing my best, so don't treat me like I'm some block-headed brace girdle from Hardbottle." That made her lose her composure and snort laugh several times in a row. When she recovered, her demeanor had considerably softened. "You almost bought the farm, Ace," she said. "Close call. We didn't know if you'd get here in time, so I did the best I could. I'm sorry I got H killed." My voice caught and I choked down a sob. "And I'm sorry I never finished reading the Silmarillion, even after I promised you I would." "I'm so sorry." "It's all right," she said. "Pull it together, Z." She motioned toward the open gates of Ongbond. "Right now, we have a quest to complete. H and Shoto are counting on us." "Okay," I said, getting to my feet. "Just give me a second. I want to call Faisal and confirm that H's vital signs are okay and check on Shoto's status again, too." She nodded, and I placed the call to Faisal, but he didn't answer. I let it ring until the call rolled to voicemail, then I hung up and turned back around to face Artemis. She had her avatar's inventory open on her HUD and was scrolling through a long list of magic items. "Do you have Angrist in your inventory?" she asked. "Or Anganor?" She produced a long, curved elven knife from her inventory. Then she took out a chain made of some sort of glowing metal and held it up too. I shook my head. A second later, my HUD helpfully informed me that Angrist was a knife that could cleave iron as if it were green wood. And I learned that Anganor was a chain forged by Aule to be stronger than all other chains. It was made of an unbreakable alloy known as Teal'c'al. "Sorry," I said. "I didn't have time to pick either of them up on my way here." Artemis handed me the knife, then equipped the chain on her belt. "Can I see the 5th shard?" she asked. I held it out, and we both reread the inscription. "Win her hand through a feat of dark renown. The last 2 shards are set in Morgoth's crown." "It's a trick, Z," she said. "Don't try to cut more than 1 Silmaril from Morgoth's crown, no matter how easy it looks. If you do, the knife will break, and you'll awaken Morgoth and all of his minions. Then we'll have Gothmog and Glaurung coming down on us, along with a host of orcs, wargs, werewolves, vampires, and Balrogs, all led by Ancalagon the Black. Baron makes the same